Welcome, funky listeners. It's Funk Radio.
Yeah.
Not sure how I almost forgot the name of the show. We've been doing this long enough.
It's Flunk Radio.
Huh. It makes sense because we fail.
Fail at everything.
This is Peter.
And this is Kyle.
Kyle, it sounds like you were just celebrating New Year's Day. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was Lunar New Year this weekend, so me and the significant other went and did stuff.
That sounds fun.
There were firecrackers and lion dancing and stuff, and adorable little Asian babies dressed up in, like, robe things. I don't know. What are those robe things called?
The babies one?
Yeah, sure.
Aoyai.
Aoyai. It's like the sound you make when you stub your toe.
Well, that sounds fun, too.
Culture and things.
Culture and things.
Speaking of culture, how do we want to lead into this, I guess?
Okay, I have a segue, but it's going to take a minute.
Okay.
So speaking of Asian things and TV, this is our segue. I just finished the anime show, Death Note,
that you recommended
to me.
Yeah, how did you like it?
I thought it was rather interesting. For listeners who don't know, it's about this guy who gets a notebook from the gods of death, which basically lets him write anybody's name in it, and then when he does that, they die. And so he basically goes on a rampage killing people, and the police have to try to catch him. So it was actually a bit more of like a detective-y show than I was expecting.
Yeah, it was kind of procedural.
In my personal opinion, I think it was probably about 50% longer than it needed to be.
Totally agree.
But it was still good, and I think the ending was still rather good.
It's funny, because that show, I think, was like 35 or 37 episodes, and normally anime seasons, and often anime that's like just a, kind of like a one-season thing, are like 26 episodes. So I think it could have done what it did in 26 episodes.
Yeah, I agree. But overall, no, I still thought it was...
Yeah, really the ending was really good, no spoilers.
So, speaking of TV, TV, sort of, in a way, was the inspiration for this episode of our show. How was that, Kyle?
That was because, I want to say in November-ish, Netflix released a Netflix show called The White Rabbit Project, which has the people from Mythbusters that aren't Adam and Jamie. They're like the helper people. I don't know what they call them
characters.
On Mythbusters.
What are they? Cary Grant and Tori. That's their own side show. Where it's very similar to Mythbusters, but the premise is a little bit different. Instead of finding myths and seeing whether or not they're true, basically I think it actually lacks a little bit of direction sometimes.
Yeah.
They basically pick a theme each episode and they say, here's like six different things that match that theme, and then we rank them based on criteria that we come up with.
It's just an interesting way to kind of that they take different subjects and explore the technology surrounding those subjects. In a way that kind of links them all together, if that makes sense.
Yeah. For example, I mean, I think one of them, like you said, it was like November or something, so it's been a little while since I've watched most of it, but I think they had six best prison escapes. They had six wackiest World War II inventions.
Yeah, the first episode was like that. The first episode was like six best superpowers. And then they tried to find technology that could replicate those powers or something.
Yeah.
That was kind of cool. So yeah, exactly. It finds things either in history or in technology or folklore or whatever, and then explores the technology and stuff used in those endeavors, I guess.
But Peter and Kyle, how is this relevant to Funk Radio?
Let me tell
you. Well, listeners, are you going to tell them or am I going to tell them?
I'll tell them. Yeah, and one of the episodes that called, quote, Invented Before Its Time, they actually covered inventions that occurred decades prior to some of today's common devices, you know, phones, computers, what have you. So they looked at things that we use and take for granted today and found like their kind of the genesis of those ideas, you know, back 30, 40, even 100 years ago. And a couple of the devices that they covered were sort of relevant to topics we've talked about before on the show, including the, I know a couple episodes back, like 8 episodes back, in episode 172, we talked about the Personics system, that sort of failed music on demand system from the, I want to say, what, the late 80s?
Oh, yeah, that was like the Redbox kiosks doing mixtapes.
Yeah, that. Yeah. And we've talked about kind of failed music technology a lot on on our show before, even the failed 45 player that they tried to have in cars in the early 60s. So I don't know, that's that kind of failed technology that kind of paves the way for other successful technologies has always been kind of interesting to me. I don't know about you.
Yeah. No, yeah, me too, definitely. And I think after, you know, at the end of that episode about the Personic system, which wasn't even 10 episodes ago, I remember us saying like, yeah, we should try to find more stuff that kind of fits that same theme, and lo and behold, this show came around and gave us a couple of good things to talk about.
I mean, we're not going to cover all 6 inventions because some of them are less relevant, but there were 2 that kind of stood out to both of us in the show. The first one that they talked about was a watch case sized phonograph that was apparently invented in 1928 and featured in that year's November issue of Popular Mechanics.
Yeah, so the premise with this was that they are claiming, in the show, they're claiming that this is more or less a precursor to the iPod or even the Walkman, where you can carry around something that lets you listen to music of your choice. I remember they actually said something about, like, oh, there was these other inventions that let you carry around a radio or wear it or whatever, but that's not really the same thing because you can only listen to what the radio is playing. So, like you said, it's basically a miniature record player that's only about maybe a couple inches wide, and it has a little, one of those like little old-timey horns on it to amplify the sound so that you can hear it. I found it rather interesting how they actually went about rebuilding it in the show.
Yeah.
Because it's not like there's any of these things still around today, unfortunately. So I believe it was Tori who was like, all right, I'm just going to build this thing. So he basically had a custom vinyl record cut that was about the size of a poker chip. And the guy who was helping him do it said, yeah, you know, you can only get about 10 seconds of audio on this thing.
Speaking of which, something I found interesting in that segment that I thought I'd tell listeners because I didn't know.
Sure.
The term, quote, cutting a record, like back in the olden days when they would print records, and I mean, obviously they still do nowadays, is actually derived from the fact that in the manufacturing of a record, they have a blank vinyl kind of slab. I forget what they called it. A blank vinyl disc, and they have what looks like a record needle, but instead of it playing the groove, it actually cuts the groove into the record, and it plays around, obviously, at I assume it plays, you know, 1-to-1 speed, but similar to CD burning, it just kind of cuts it into the record, and then when it's done, you can then play it back. But what's funny is, as it's cutting this groove into the vinyl, it spits out all this, like, basically plastic confetti.
That's a good way of putting it.
I forget what they called it. It was like scroll or scrum or something, some weird word.
Yeah.
And as it's cutting, the guy has to kind of, you know, grab up the confetti and kind of continually filter it away so it doesn't get in the way of the needle. But he's like, oh yeah, by the way, this stuff is actually really, really flammable. And they lit some on fire and it just instantly burst into flames.
Fun fact.
It kind of reminded me of, I don't know if you remember the film Inglourious Basterds, that old film that they used in the 40s that apparently was extremely flammable.
Oh, I forgot about that, yeah.
I don't know why it reminded me of that. But yeah, no, I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing because I never really thought to look how a record's produced. And yeah, that's how they're made, and that's why it's called cutting.
You know what we should do, which would be really awesome? We should be like Mr. Rogers and go every so often factory. Have an episode where we go to like a factory and see how
I would seriously love to go made. To a record producing factory. Another fun fact, that'd apparently fun. Jack White, formerly of the White Stripes, he has a recording studio in Tennessee called Third Man Records, and he recently announced that he wants to open a full-sized record producing factory in Detroit. So to produce neat. Either his own material or to, you know, produce material for other artists on other labels, what have you. So it kind of shows, you know, that the record industry is rebooming in a way. America, that's bringing cool. jobs back.
So as you mentioned a minute ago, this watch case phonograph was featured. Actually, oh, before I say that, which one is he? Is he Tori, I guess? He did actually succeed in making this thing, by the way.
Yeah.
Which I thought was rather cool. It's hard to tell, like, when watching this show what the thing actually sounds like, because I think they just kind of, like,
I think they faked it.
But they said that it worked. I mean, they said it was quiet, but it worked if you put your ear right up to it, which I found really interesting. And so apparently, I mean, that's basically the first time anyone had tried to make one of those in like 80 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, extra funny thing I found about it was when he reassembled it, he actually 3D printed the phonograph horn because you can't find a phonograph horn very easily, let alone one that small. So I thought it was kind of interesting that they're using modern technology to reproduce old technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was kind of cool.
Neat. So as I was going to say a minute ago, this watch case phonograph was featured in the November 1928 issue of Popular Mechanics, and there's actually an image online. I wouldn't call it an ad, it's just like a very short blurb about it plus a picture. It said, quote, practical use is claimed for a tiny phonograph that fits into a watch case and is operated by a small spring. Its records will hold about 15 spoken words, and these can be reproduced by the owner to show the quality of her voice and reproduced for talking films. The entire outfit can be carried in a vanity bag.
I especially love the blurb that was in the original article that said that it turns a, quote, midget record. Because back in 1928...
Yeah, actually, that one, that's a blurb from the June 1936 issue of Popular Science.
Oh.
So... That's actually, what is that, 8 years later?
Yeah.
Or so. This thing actually popped up a second time. And it said, quote, called the world's tiniest talking machine, a miniature phonograph has been built into the case of a watch. When wound by the watch stem, a small spring mechanism turns a midget record. Sound is reproduced through a diminutive horn. So again, it's not clear what... the practical application of this is.
I don't think there was one even then.
It doesn't, and I can't even tell from this, like, did they sell it? What was their actual...
A lot of things in Popular Mechanics and even back then were kind of inventions made for the sake of saying, I can make this.
Yeah.
Kind of like, I don't know if you remember the old, like, Chicago World's Fair in, like, 1910 or whatever. A lot of the stuff that they would feature at these world fairs were often, like, inventions created to impress the masses, but never intended for mass production.
That's a good point. It definitely seems like more of a gimmicky, like, here's what we are able to do with technology, rather than...
It's the 1928 version. It's the 1928 version of Hit Clips.
Oh my god, it is! That's right? Amazing. Oh, holy crap. Sadly, that I think has to be like the closest quote unquote modern day
interpretation
equivalent.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really funny.
Man, those things were so funny. I if we ever do an episode on those, I want to buy one on eBay just to say so I still have one. Yeah.
Well, I have it written down in our ideas list.
We can do like a YouTube unboxing of it.
So, yeah, I mean, as much as I guess we could say it was not really practical or it, you know, it didn't even necessarily reach the masses, I still think it's pretty impressive that in you know, 1928, they almost were able to make... Almost 90 years ago, they were able to make a miniature working...
Phonograph.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Because even him remaking it today, I mean, it took him a bit of effort at some steps to get it to work, so... I thought that was kind of cool.
Very cool. Yeah, no, it's just funny that people were thinking about portability even back then. I mean, I guess it's not too crazy to think that, you know, whatever technology of the time, there's always going to be someone who thinks, how can I make this smaller? How can I make this more convenient?
So completely going against that idea.
Yeah.
We have our second invention called the telharmonium, which was invented in 1906. And this thing was massive, basically took up the size of a warehouse. I think that in the show they said it was 60 feet long and weighed over 200 tons. So definitely not a miniaturization by any means. So the deal with the telharmonium, it was first conceived by this guy, Thaddeus Cahill, in 1897. God. And so the idea behind this huge mechanical thing is that he was thinking, what if I could make a service where people could call on the telephone, which was a new concept at the time, and so was electricity, by the way. What if people could call on the telephone and say, hey, I want to listen to this music, and then this service says okay, and then they play this music for them through the telephone. So this is in the White Rabbit show, they were saying this was like the predecessor to listening to music on our phones, as everyone does today. So the interesting thing about how this thing actually worked and why it was so large, the idea behind it is that there's these magnetic like metal cogs that are spinning around. And when you introduce electricity to these metal cogs that are spinning, it makes a tone. And if you have ones of different sizes, it makes different tones. So Thaddeus Cahill is basically like, hey, you know, if I connect all these together into an organ, I can recreate the sound of an orchestra electronically, basically. And without realizing it, he made the very first synthesizer in 1906.
Yeah, I thought that was impressive.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty insane. I'm really impressed that he was able to actually build this damn thing, because, you know, he has all these like huge, these massive, you know, metal cylinders that are all spinning around in this warehouse. They're all connected by wires and everything up into this organ where I think they said it takes at least two people to play it at once. To, you know, playing all these different tones to actually make music. And then it's being channeled through these wires into the telephone lines, you know, to whoever may have requested this. I mean, the idea itself is actually pretty pretty crazy, especially for the time. Because, I mean, you know, like I said, electricity and telephones were new technologies themselves. And then for him to say, well, let's make a practical application for this.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, too, because, like you said, that electricity, you know, and the telephone both had been invented only maybe a decade prior, and even the telephone wasn't, you know, massively adopted at that point. The only thing that I think that made me sad about this particular invention was it was kind of a victim of its timing, because the phone and the electrical lines hadn't been mass produced and kind of perfected yet. There were a lot of inherent problems with it. Just maintaining the thing alone was very cost prohibitive. And apparently, oftentimes when people would call into the service, they would get, I guess, like crosstalk of people's conversations going through the phone line of other people while they were trying to listen to music, which obviously would be unwanted. But it's even crazier to think that over 110 years ago, people were even thinking of the idea of something on demand, let alone music. I mean, the television hadn't even been invented yet, and some guy's like, how can I get people to listen to music whenever they want without having a physical device in their home?
Well, yeah, that's the big, and the big thing to me is not only is the idea like way ahead of its time, but he was actually able to build it. It wasn't like just a concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he was only able to keep it running for a couple of years before it basically just became a giant money pit and he couldn't deal with it anymore. But the cool thing was that this invention of his ended up being the foundation for an invention, what, 30 years later, called the Hammond organ, which basically takes the same concept and condenses it down into something basically the size of a piano.
Yeah, I mean, the Hammond organ is like one of the major, you know, instruments of kind of like the synthesizer era.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe even a bit, you know, predating it a bit, but it was like one, it's that one by itself is considered one of like the, you know, really important ones. And then this is basically like the direct inspiration for that. Basically, the Hammond organ was able to perfect it by using miniaturization when the technology allowed for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because that also has like those spinning metal discs within it. But like I said, they could do it at a much smaller scale.
Yeah, they're like the size of like, you know, a silver dollar rather than like as tall as a man.
Yeah, exactly. And I had never actually known that that's how the Hammond organ worked.
I didn't either.
So I found that rather interesting. So, I mean, not only was the concept good, but he was able to build it. And even though it failed on its own, it still paved the way for synthesizers many decades before they were
mm-hmm.
a popular thing.
Yeah, it's so funny. I would argue that of these two inventions, this one more directly inspired future technology, because as you said, it was condensed and created the Hammond organ. It paved the way for synthesizers. The watch case phonograph, while the concept is interesting and it got people thinking about the idea of portability, I can't think of anything that directly sprung off of that, you know?
Right. And at the time, it was only like a gimmicky thing anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the telharmonium might have been as well, but at least it was put to use.
Yeah, it was intended to be used by people and customers, yeah. But it just didn't pan out.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess that's that. Those are two rather cool inventions. If you'd like to learn more about them, in particular the telharmonium, there's quite a bit of information on that one online or at your local library that you can go.
Library, what's that? I still have my library card from when I was a kid in Illinois.
That's pretty cool.
Yep.
Do you think it still works?
I'm pretty sure it's expired. Oh no, I still have that book overdue. I owe them like $900
for the Boxcar Children.
Shut up! I totally read that series as a kid.
No, I know. I was just trying to think of something that
we would have read. Wasn't there a Seinfeld episode where like Kramer had a book overdue, or Jerry, or someone?
Oh, and then they had the book cop.
Yeah, yeah.
Who like tracked him down or whatever? I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just funny.
So yeah, if you want to go to your local library, here's how you get there. Go to Google, and you type in whatever you want.
Type in library.
Type in library.
Go to Google, type in library, see that it's like 6 miles away, say fuck that, go back to Google, type in any book you want in the world, and it'll come up.
Well, funny that we're joking about that, but those clips that I pulled from the 1928 Popular Mechanics and the 1936 Popular Science were both like on Google Books or whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
They were just like archived.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think
there. I was able to find them through that means. So I guess
any public, what do you call it? Printing, I guess, before like, I want to say 1930 is considered public domain. So I guarantee all that stuff is archived.
There you go.
And not only that, because Google is a worldwide website, other countries have less strict public domain laws than the U.S. So
I know,
for example, it's kind of eerily funny right now. Apparently, the book 1984 is the best-selling book on Amazon.
That's funny. I didn't know about that.
For very ominous reasons. But in the article that I read that mentioned that, they're like, oh yeah, if you want to get it on Kindle or whatever, it's like $2. But since Canada and Britain have less strict copyright laws than the US, that too, you can actually go and find it for free from Canadian sources because it falls into their public domain because it came out in 1948. So, fun facts.
So, there are places you can find us, listeners.
You can look in a book.
Take a look. We're not in a book, but we are on Facebook. At facebook.com/getyourfunk. You can tell us things that you have invented. Or you can tell us on...
Peter.
God damn it. I was trying to think of something. You can tell us on soundcloud.com/getyourfunk. If you follow us there, our most recent 4 or 5 episodes at a time will be there. Mixcloud.com/getyourfunk is like where we're trying to put all of our full archive of episodes. I've been uploading more of our old stuff there lately.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, yesterday, got us onto... I didn't even know this was a thing until recently. Google Play Music has podcasts.
Ooh.
Similar to the way iTunes does. So now we're on Google Play.
Nice.
I'm actually trying to figure out iTunes to get us back up there, but there's some really weird shit going on with the RSS feed, and it's basically preventing us from doing that.
Lame. Also, we're kind of... I should say we. Peter's kind of low-key working on also a pseudo... I don't know what you call it. Unaffiliated website. Blog website. Yeah. Where we're going to be hosting our archive as well. We're basically just linking to Mixcloud, but we have our own blog site, I guess, and it looks prettier, so.
Yeah, it's most straightforward way to like find our episodes and search for ones that you want to listen to and whatnot. So that's in the works.
Yeah, coming soon.
More on that later.
Under construction. So, hope you listeners just keep inventing stuff to make the world a better place.
Next time, we'll invent another episode. But until then...
This has been your host, Kyle.
And this has been your host, Peter. Thanks for listening to Funk Radio. You'll listen to us next time.
Or else...